Louisiana. We're also operating services as a result of Hurricane Katrina in Baton Rouge, which is where we landed after the storm. And part of our story, of course, is that prior to the storm, we had 5 primary care sites in New Orleans serving about 12,000 patients. After the storm, as a result of the storm, all but one of those facilities were completely destroyed. And in fact, even at this point in time, although we have now 5 sites that are operating, they are fairly small sites, usually 4,000 to 6,000 square feet, but we're now up to serving 16,000 patients. So we've grown post-Katrina from serving in 2006, 4,066 patients, roughly now to 16,000 patients. So we are in the rebuilding phase. Also, as a result, we are rebuilding our facilities. We have one site that is going up as part of our collaborative with the Daughters of Charities of New Orleans, which is one of our partners, which is going to be a 33,000 square foot facility, and another that they're working on, which is 25. We're working on a 26,000 square foot facility. So we are rebuilding our system. We serve primarily, as was in the introduction, those who are underserved, those who are uninsured, but we're open to all. We refuse services to no one based upon ability to pay. We have a population now that is about 90% African American. Before the storm, it was about 97% African American. The difference now is that there's been a large influx of Hispanic individuals into the community. We also have somewhat significant Middle Eastern population that comes to our clinic, because we do have some providers that do speak the appropriate languages for Middle Eastern population, so they're very attractive to that particular group. We serve from prenatal care to geriatrics. We have an affiliation with the PACE program, which provides Medicaid managed care for the elderly. And so we essentially see everyone from birth to, unfortunately, to death through age. We do have some special programs. We do have an HIV prevention program. We're part of the PA 4060 program. It's on its way out, which has been HIV prevention. And of course, we're in competition for the renewal of that grant. We've at the past also provided HIV primary care before the storm, and had some part or participation in that after the storm, but we're not able to really continue to provide HIV primary care for lack of an appropriate provider, and essentially worked with our state program, the HIV outpatient program, and transferring those resources to them. And in an integrated care model, which Kathy is going to talk about, I think it's important to know that we essentially have the appropriate clinicians dealing. We have pediatricians, family practitioners, nurse practitioners, psychiatrists, clinical social workers. We have a clinical pharmacist that works along with us, as well as we have podiatrists. We have we have an ophthalmologist that works in a lot of our diabetes program, and a nutritionist. And throughout our network, we do a lot of referrals from one program to another. It's not to say that all of those services are available in each and every of our 5 sites, but we do make a lot of referrals from point A to point C or D or E, where those services are. And I think I left out, we have dental services as well. So I think that's a kind of like a roundabout of where we are.
Thanks, Mike. What he left out was that he's also, when we get to the question and answer period, he had his sites and his system is certified at a level 3 by NCQA for the patient medical home. So he can answer any questions on what it took as a leader and as a business case to implement that within his system. Luann, you want to give a little bit about your health center?
Okay. Good morning. As was stated, I work at Geiger Gibson Community Health Center. We were the first community health center. We're part of an agency that includes two other health centers, another one in Dorchester, a neighborhood in Boston, and a health center on Cape Cod. We see 25,000 patients a year at all three health centers. We have dental services on the Cape and in our health center at Geiger Gibson. The health center at Geiger Gibson provides the only Ryan White dental care in the city for people living with HIV. We have a very robust HIV screening and education program, which also includes STI screening and education through the primary care services at our health center. We have adult medicine, family practice, pediatrics, OBGYN, at our other health center. We have three physicians, two nurse practitioners, a nursing staff, medical assistants. We're open 6 days a week, and we're open 5 nights a week until 9 o'clock. And we also have a daycare, which has always been. So we really care for whole families, where our pediatrician is actually caring for the fourth generation of a family. We're definitely a part of the community. In terms of demographics, the Spanish is the second language of choice in our patient population. Our site sees about 6,500 patients a year. The other Boston Health Center sees about 13,000 patients a year, and then the Cape makes up the rest of those. And each health center is very distinctly different in terms of the makeup of the race and ethnicity in the program. So we have staff that speak the languages that our patients speak. The Geiger Gibson Health Center is transforming from what was actually embedded in a public housing project and is changing with the privatization of that housing project to a very different community. So it's a mixture of our population that have always lived in that community and students from UMass, including many new immigrants who are coming to Boston to go to school. From places, particularly people from places in Africa, such as Nigeria, Somalia, and Cameroon. And 80% of our patients are living below 200% of the poverty level.
To begin our talk, I just want to thank Mike and Luann for joining me today. They really are the experts. As you know, this is not a session about what the health center is, what the model is. I'm just assuming. How many people here work with health centers in their communities? Great, because that's not what I'm covering. And they really are the experts. I am the facilitator. And what I'm going to try and do today is address the changes that are happening. We are in a very dynamic environment right now. It is very dynamic, and for the first time in history, we are addressing access, quality, and cost. Since Hammurabi's Code, it is the first time in history those three things are being addressed at the same time. And that is why there's so much chaos in the field, and it's coming from multiple different places. And so I'm gonna just try and highlight what those issues are, what the drivers are at, from the national level, some of the state activity that's going on, and actually how it plays out on the local level. We consider this very informal, so please feel free to ask any questions. I'm supposed to. This is NAC's mission. Obviously, we're committed to the underserved to provide high quality care. It's legislated, but I think people have confusion. There's approximately 1,200 health centers across the country, 7,500 sites that serve 20 million patients. However, most health centers receive about from 5% federal dollars to 100%. And people think that the Bureau funds most of their activities. health centers discovered that they had to diversify their funding a long time ago, so that they're real growing businesses. Also, in context, 1 in 3 live in poverty, and 1 in 4 are minorities. We serve the same patient population. In addition, a little over 900,000 are in the farm worker migrant population, and over 1 million are homeless. The other dynamic that's hit us this year is a changing economy and the era stimulus dollars. And what that really plays out in the field as health centers nationally, their visits were up 14%. The uninsured were up close to 20%. There was a perception out there that health centers are getting all this dollars given to them, and there was a lot. And so the reality was that those are really earmarked for capital funds, IT, and at the state level, because the state level, the economy was broken as well, they're actually on the ground, we're seeing a decrease in Medicaid reimbursements. So the health centers are seeing more people with less dollars. Just to put, that's another changing environment. Again, I think briefly, thanks to Mike and Luann, you can hold the questions for them on the specifics of the medical home. I'd like to begin. I found a quote that I think summarizes sort of where we are in the primary care public health relationship. Today, the two cultures, medicine and public health, seem to live in different worlds, often unfriendly worlds. This was not always the case. Experience with the universities, health departments, and governments during 4 decades have convinced me that continued separation of these two enterprises greatly diminishes their combined scientific, organization, and institutional potentials. I think that's really a challenge for us today, to figure out where the synergies are. We need to meet in the middle. And this schism was recently reinforced because I'm partnering with NACHO trying to figure out how we can work better together. And health departments and health centers, a majority of them are within 5 miles of each other, and a majority of them can't figure out how to collaborate. And I think it's more cultural and mission-driven than I think it's actually the context. Here are some national drivers, but again, I wanna say these are the huge things, but again, these underlying this is healthcare reform, but it's all trying to deal with access, value, and cost. You see embedded here, this is a shrinking primary care workforce. You're dealing with it, we're dealing with that. The challenge is we need to come up with new medical models, new staffing models. For the first time, health centers have to put 6 to 10% of their budget into IT. We need IT people there. We have under this new administration, a need and a want for data, uniform data sets that show, that justify patient outcomes, improved health outcomes, create the business case for the work that we do, and also that foster transparency. I know with my work with DEMS and the IPP programs, those forms are really grant monitoring forms and not necessarily intervention forms. And that's not the way the patient encounter goes. So we've got to have these worlds coming together and figuring out one uniform data set that gives us the measurement tools that we need. Medicine needs to be evidence-based. We tried to do a prevention collaborative about 5 years ago. How many remember Ebstat screening? We all do Ebstat screening, right. Do you know there is nothing that says that that's evidence-based and we still do it? There's no measurements. So part of it might be we have to let go of some of the work that we've done because there's no clinical evidence. And then we have to pick up the things that we do know that are. We have this plethora of vocabulary, collaborate. It's in your program expectations, it's in our program expectations. Very little on how to make that work. Very little about staffing models to do that. Very little about percentage of time on your job. So we've got to figure out the collaboration model. And also, again, there's convergence of quality of care, quality of measurement, health disparities, costs, value, and the systems need to be built. The systems actually need to be built to improve this. And that's what you see here. You see medical home accountability organizations. 5 years ago, you never heard of that. Performance measure and improved public reporting. We were all collecting data. It was not transparent. It was not uniform. Information technology, everybody, how many people here have heard meaningful use? And all the drivers around that. Primary care, public health, workforce crisis. We're in the middle of that as well. State and national health care reform. Unfortunately, what's happening, these are all independent drivers. They are not coordinating across. And so we actually now have a bigger responsibility on the community level to make sure that they're aligned and coordinated. I'll give you an example. Our LGBT task force was recently looking at LGBT issues. And what they found out is that LGBT was missing out of meaningful use. However, it was now part of JCO accreditation. So that the same thing that's happening in mental health and behavioral health, the way it was in meaningful use was driven by a physician, but that's not the way it's practiced in the field. So the wording had to be changed, and the measurements and incentives has to be changed. So these are very serious things that are going to implement things down the road. This is kind of our model for primary care of the future. We have population health. I think that's where we have a lot of synergy. Access healthy communities and eliminate. We have a very, you'll see this in the terminology with the medical home, citizen-centered patient activation, patient self-management, family engagement, that they have responsibility, they're accountable for their own goal setting, that includes equity and access. For many of our patient population, that doesn't play out. And so that's a big part of the medical home model, that everything has a cost, but that the cost and value are there. It's built into the system of care. Now, this is just really brief to show some of the things. We do similar work. We do it in parallel. And one is the public health. This came from the IOM. We both do assessments. Your job is to do assessments and surveillance. Health centers have to do community needs assessment. They get their data sometimes from you, but the community assessment is something that would be very smart to work together on because it would be very leveraged. New York Health Department does that. They do some things together, but that's an opportunity to work together. We both have policy development arms. We need to work together so those are aligned and there's synergy, both at the national level through what I call administrative policy, like through the CDC, but also legislative policies within our states. We all are doing quality assurance. We're coming at it at different angles, and this just highlights some of them. I'm not going to read it. And also, about 5% of health centers are actively engaged in research. But there's new research models and practice models and transformational models that we could work together on. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail on the meaningful use. I think that, again, the point is that we have to pay attention to what that is, so it gives us the data that we need for the patients that we serve. And the purpose of it is to improve quality and safety, again, measuring and collecting data from the patients and families. It's about coordination of care across systems, and that uniform data set is critical because it does not exist yet. The challenge on the mental health, HIV, and STD, as you know, are going to be on the patient privacy issues. There's Patient Privacy Coalition that are looking at nothing more than protecting the rights of patients and what data is being shared and how it's going to be shared and who can see that data. And then improving, again, with our commitment to improving population health. This is a neutral slide. Just to give you sort of the projections, what's going to happen, it's moving fast, the train has left the station, and everybody better be on that train or you're going to be catching up. CMS has said that by 2015, they will start imposing penalties if it's not up to date. And now that would be on reimbursement for health centers, so that's huge. So their systems, there's a huge... a lot of work being done aligning IT infrastructure. Now, part of the whole meaning for use is one piece. That's kind of a business process, the IT infrastructure, the EMR, the right instrument, the right implementation, the right use. And that has to go across communities. Another new evolution that's coming as part of the medical home model is what has happened is everyone really sort of was managing their own workload. What wasn't being managed is the things that happened in between. If you're a biology major, I say we worked in ourselves and we worked very well, but we never worked in the interstitial space. And the interstitial space is where all the activity is, it's where all the creativity is, it's where all the innovation is. What's happening now are these accountable care organizations are coming hold. They're different in every communities. They're committed to monitor patients across organizations, and there's certain characteristics. The provider can manage the continuum of care, and virtually integrated service delivery model. That sounds so easy, but I will tell you, these two people over here will tell you how hard an integrated service delivery model is to develop and build capacity and to make it work. IT is one sliver of that integrated model. That there's sufficient size to support comprehensive performance measurement and improvement. I think you heard there the changes that Mike had to make in after Katrina, that even though they, almost quadrupled your patient level, you still had to work in very small spaces and you had to figure out how to work differently. Just so you know, I want to say they were modest when they say their patient population is 16,000. The average health center seeks care, which has implications for STD and HIV access to care issues, is that the average health center patient is seen at a health center 4 to 5 times a year. That's an average. Some may come 6 to 8. So that will give you some concept of the workload and logistics in as you're beginning to implement a healthcare home model. And that, again, the business model. Health centers, we accept it. Never, because part of grants, you don't create the business model. These organizations know we're in an era where we have to be able to document cost and improve their value, and that your system is able to collect that data and to report out. Two different steps. Here is sort of a visual on how accountability care organizations could work. I like that word, they're care integrators, and they link fragmented entities. You can see you have your provider group, then you have your funders, the health plans, and your insurance things, and then you have those other pieces that are like supporting or enabling services. And I can tell you from the health center model and the way we're going, oral health is an integrated part of it. HIV, without a doubt, health centers own that. It's integrated into primary care. As you'll see, substance abuse is more and more and more integrated into primary care with new administrative and legislative things happening and funding through SAMHSA. It's an integration that's happening, and that separateness is actually making the system fragile. So in preparing for what's going to happen in the future, you have to figure out how you're going to integrate and where you need to come. But this is a model. Now, the patient-centered care medical home model. Do you know most health centers have written in their missions, we are the medical home? They think they're the medical home. You probably think you're the medical home for STDs and HIV. This is very different, and I think this is where words are very important. There is a lot of bite behind this patient-centered medical home. There is capacity, there are systems, there's money, there's a workforce that has to be involved in it. And this is an aim. It's really transforming the way practices happen, and again, managing care across organizations all the way from prevention, care and treatment, acute care, chronic care, across the life cycle. And all of that needs system building and capacity building. Interestingly, the provider groups rarely get on board of things. They are totally behind the patient-centered care model. And this train is way out of the station. NCQA, do people here know who NCQA is? Okay, see heads nodding. NCQA has also developed a certification program on the medical home that is very recognized. Now, both Mr. Andre and Luann have, Mr. Andre has successfully gone through it and is at the highest level, his system of care. Luann is in the process of implementing it, but there is a lot of work that has to happen to make that work. In a minute, it takes approximately 6 months to prepare a system to go under the survey process. And within that, I'm going to go into detail right now on what that medical home, what it takes to get the certification. But up front, there are three levels. There's three levels for the NCQA certification process. Many health centers around the country are going after NCQA, patient-centered care model certification. The level one is that you have, it's really based on bringing, again, three components: access, quality, and cost, and IT as the mechanism to connect those dots. For a level one, you need to have documentation of the care and services you provide for that patient. It can be manual, practice management systems, but mostly manual. Level two is that you have to have, it's a step further, practice management systems and registry, documenting of care. Number three is you actually have an integrated model. You have a team approach to the care that you give. You have an EMR that can exchange information externally, bilaterally, and that you have a dedicated quality improvement staff. So there is definition. It doesn't come free. It is very costly. They have a formula where they do the recognition by the number of providers that you have. And so they actually know the implementation model, but that is the scope of what they have to do internally. In the country, yep?
What are the incentives for going through that, and what are the resources available to allow that to happen? It doesn't come cheap.
The incentives are yet to be determined.
There, yes. This is very interesting. There are no incentives to do it. But this is the incentive. This is the incentive. CMS has a demonstration. It got put on hold because of some problems with the stimulus dollars. They are in the process of rolling out a five-year demonstration. 31 states have legislative medical home initiatives. Those are the reality of the world. We have this documented. I brought one state just to give you some understanding of what's in the law. This is Iowa's Medical Home Initiative. They have an advisory council. They have the file number, and this is what's in their law, Iowa's law. The state law states that it has to be a team approach, quality improvement effort. We've been trying to do quality improvement for 40 years. Team approach to providing health care fosters a partnership, again, patient activation, community engagement, that professionals and providers are partners with their patients and their communities. It's access to medical and non-medical. So now you're seeing a convergence of that's where the STD, the enabling services, the translation services, this is legislated. So they don't tell you how, you've got to figure out the how. Maintains a centralized comprehensive record, the IT, and then it goes further. In Iowa, these are the people that are on the council. And I think, you know, given the states that you're on, I would suggest that you highly look at what's going on in your state and become part of that, or you will be sort of told what to do versus invited. but you can see the cross-section of people that are engaged in Iowa. The Iowa Medical Home is really they want to design and build capacity around their patient medical home. They're gonna design the organizational structure and the standards for certification. That's where that NCQA certification, everyone is accepting. I haven't heard. JACO is coming up with a similar one, but right now I have to tell you that NCQA is considered the golden standard for medical home certification. Focus on systems. We have very complicated systems that don't understand each other, that don't read each other. They're simplifying their system. They're determining reimbursement methodologies that probably weren't available before that are going to be available now. And again, you can see that word integration again. They focused, which many of them do, on the Medicaid population. However, in Iowa, they're including the state employees, and they are engaging with the private sector as well. Now, the specifics to the NCQA medical home, I'm just going to write some of the complexities so you understand what it really actually takes to get that NCQA certification. These are the elements of the medical home. It's involved in a personal relationship. It's all about engaging the patient, self-management, their family, and coordinating that relationship with the provider across systems. It engages a team approach, so you have a cross-sectional team that designs your system, your measurements, and moves things forward. It's coordinated. The burden is no longer on the patient to coordinate their care. The system takes over coordinating their care. Quality and safety. How many remember the mid-90s, the IOM's quality chasm? This is the next phase. This is the driver behind the quality chasm. Interesting, we just, NAC as an organization, just finished a National Staff Satisfaction Survey. Very fascinating. Totally a myth buster for myself, who's been working at health centers since 1991. The number one priority for health center staff was patient safety. I was totally shocked. Number one, and this was very rigorous, random stratified sample, but that tells you where the culture is. People care that their patients are getting good care, that there are no medical errors, there's continuity of care. Expanded access. That's what our dialogue is about. That's how public health departments, STD clinics, HIV, health centers can be a new access point. That's our vocabulary. Your vocabulary might be increased testing or linking to care. Ours is increasing new access points. And that it's added value, that people are linked to a medical home, that they get continuity of care, and that improves their health outcomes. Why are people getting NCQA certification? I'm going to let you ask those two people over there, because I think, you know, it's an interesting piece. But globally, it's because it gives you the tools and capacity to provide superior care. It's evidenced in best practices. It has a quality insurance built-in quality improvement efforts. And we're looking for, ultimately, obviously, down the road with CMS and Medicaid, where they're looking at incentivizing. It'll increase reimbursement. These are the standards for recognition. This is what you have, the capacity building issues that you have to have in place. You have to have a very effective communication system, again, vertically and bilaterally, and that takes on many components. Patient tracking and registry functions, which is very challenging. EMRs and registries, it is a very difficult thing, and I'll again defer to them. Care management, care coordination. There are several states who are legislating the care management and the care coordination, and this impacts the workforce. Some are designating that RNs have got to be doing all the care management. And in a shrinking workforce and a shrinking RN capacity, this is huge. The care coordination and case management. The care coordination is defined more like you set up an appointment, it's more of a logistical piece. The case management and care coordination is that you actually get the results back and they get acted on and somebody's looking at it and making sure that patient and family is engaged. So it's a very active process. Patient self-management tools and support, electronic prescribing, test tracking, referral tracking, performance reporting and improvement. It goes back to that data collection, how important it is to have uniform data collection points that can be used across the system, and advanced electronic communication. Now what I'd like to do is just shift a little bit and say, okay, this is the medical home, we have healthcare reform, we have all these dynamics going on that are driving the work that we do in the states and within local health centers. My two partners here are what we call early adopters. They're out there in front, they're trying to do things, and they've got strong leadership, they have strong capacity, doesn't make it easy. However, there's a continuum. You've said it, you've seen one health center, you've seen one health center, so there's a lot more work that has to be done. So I'd like to just briefly say how these health center, state health department collaborations can work. Again, here's a collaboration. Actually, we've been very effective in working with HIV and the DIS officer and building them into the health center team in our testing initiative. There are some health centers out there that actually have shared staff with the health department. That's a very effective model. Improved access to care. How do we coordinate those referrals and linkages? In that survey we just completed with NACHO, it was very interesting. And I could feel it in their hearts. They're saying, we refer patients to health centers for treatment, but the health center won't take them. And that's a common theme. Well, there are rules. What is a health center patient? They have to actually be a health, we're not an urgent care model. And so it's the patient actually needs to be a patient of the health center, otherwise they get on a waiting list. In this environment, some health centers have 1,400 to 1,500 patients waiting because they're at capacity. They're just at capacity. So I think those referral and linkages actually can be designed, but it has to be designed at the community level. It's nothing that can be dictated even from a state level. It's who are the partners. When we did our HIV survey, health centers, when you do a survey, they write all over it and tell you how awful you are and what you should be doing. But this one is very potent. It said, we're the poorest county in the U.S. We don't have any money to waste. We got around the table and we figured out who can do what, and we avoid any duplicate of services. Smart. They were smart. That's what we need to do. Population, we have partner notification, I think, is an area we probably could strengthen. Outreach to the community, we could leverage that more effectively since, again, remember, patients are coming into the health center 4 to 5 times a year. Education and information around STD testing and prevention. I think there's work to be done in health centers around that. But our lessons learned is the physicians are very busy, and we need to create models to do that, that shows them the value added, that it doesn't ruin the patient time in the health center, and develop that capacity. And we have models that we could do that more effectively around STD. And I think we need to work together to further define the collaboration. I think that's a pretty loose term on collaboration. Then I went around to my friends in the health departments and I said, what do you need from health centers? And they said, we need to know that health centers are actually an untapped market. These are direct quotes. That FQHCs are a vital service to the safety net, and that they can assist with HIV and STDs with high risk groups. Because again, those patients are going in there for primary care. But the how is tricky. The local and state health departments said they need to really have a better understanding of health centers. They really don't understand how they work. We have a sister organization. We're the National Association. We have a state partner called Primary Care Associations. They are equally working on policy issues, IT infrastructure, clinical capacity building. They also do policy work on the state level that could be leveraged. They need to work on the relationship. It's like any partner, you have to cultivate the relationship. It's just not going to be given to you. And one person particularly felt that he needed expedited help on the legislation on expedited partner therapy. What health centers need from health departments, I did the same thing, same questions. Very different answers, however. health centers really wanted concrete things. Raul and CDC and NAC jointly sponsored a meeting back in June 4th and 5th, and Raul presented us with some high prevalence areas, and we invited the health center team from those areas, and then we invited the local health department and state health department from those same areas. The health centers don't know the prevalence. They don't know the data. But if they see the data, then they like go, oh my gosh. So access to the data is really a hook to do that. And one of the things that's common, again, I'm repeating, is that community assessment, because they need the data for their grants and other things. The coordination and sharing of benefits and resources is huge. For instance, how many here know about 07768, the HIV testing kit initiative? Everybody knows. Actually, I know very few health centers that have received any test kits nationally. And so that is a structural issue. It's not a lack of a want to do it. Actually, our survey, we did a quick and dirty survey, 283 health centers are implementing routine HIV screening without any support. So I think that that's an area of opportunity. You need a shared vision, you need to share resources. Data chart, you know, you training charts, the DIS coordination, the staffing. The other kind of cultural thing is what is lacking is we need to create a model on how to integrate STD and HIV actually into the primary care visit. And that is a design issue. That can be done. It's not that difficult. Again, in closing, I just decided to summarize for everybody kind of some top resources on all the different issues. Meaningful use. The HHS site is actually very good because it has everything documented and you can do it across divisions. If you want to see what NAC is doing, we also have a blog. We have multiple users groups on EMRs, registries, and all of that is being documented and posted online so you can see where we're coming from. I actually have handouts. I forgot. The medical home resources, I think how many of here have heard the National Academy of State Health Policy? They actually have excellent, excellent work. Mary Tagajic is working on it. She's funded by the Commonwealth Fund. Her job is only the medical home. She's an incredible resource. Their website is an incredible resource. Both for what's going on in the individual states and their legislation, but also in some of their formalized paper. Primary Care Development Organization was funded by the Commonwealth Fund. You can go to that site and actually download the implementation, how to do a patient-centered medical home in your organization. Regina Neal is the contact there. These are all the other types of resources. For public health and primary care tools, we're a little bit more limited. as part of the work with Raul, what we are doing and working with NACHO, actually to create a guide on the patient medical home in the context of public health primary care relationship that will have everything outlined in one document, and we'll probably have a draft probably early May, early June. And I'm working with their committee structure to act as reviewers, and it'll be available free online by the end of the summer. And then on the NAC website, again, getting into the level of detail you need to implement something in a primary care setting. We have worked with the CDC on implementing routine HIV screening in non-Ryan White health centers. And that means they have zero extra dollars, because if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. And all the tools are there, how we did it, the forms, the cheat sheets, the job aids, the models are all there available on our site. And now this is the overview, and we'd like to entertain any questions you might have. Go. Go ahead.
It sounds like the medical home is the next iteration of trying to do what managed care was intended to do, where you have one primary
provider.
And they coordinate all your care. So I'm hoping that maybe the community health centers will adopt the NCQA HEDIS measures as a group of standards that they should achieve, and that would enable us to encourage them to be consistent with the chlamydia screening guideline.
See, you know that meaningful use? Uniform data collection, evidence-based. The HEDIS measures are one measure, but they're for health plans.
But it's the same thing.
Well, yeah, it is the same thing, but actually there are other agencies that have different, I mean, this is not just for HEDIS, it's just not, but it's for hemoglobin A1Cs, it's for mammography, it's for all of that. And so there's a National Quality Forum that is looking at aligning all of those outcome measures, and there's another group that is out doing those, and they're doing these crosswalks.
Because what I've heard from the community health system that we work with most closely, and they're actually part of our infertility prevention project, is that their providers really don't have any incentive to screen for chlamydial infection because it's not one of the things that they're held accountable for.
Mr. Andre, would you like to address that question as the CEO of an organization?
You're absolutely right.
I think it is an important thing that there are so many different drivers, there are so many different incentives or disincentives that in the world of the community health center that they have to evaluate which are our targets, which ones do we go after, because you know there's only a limited amount of attention that you can focus to everything until you build all the systems to sort of like operate by default by remote. And so for things like chlamydia screening, that might be one of those. I do think that there are, in the whole notion in terms of the HEDIS measures, for example, HRSA does give us several outcome measures that we are required to report on. I participate on, and so that's say maybe 9 or 10. I participate with another group with United Health Foundation Centers of Excellence, which has another 9 or 10. We participate with another collaborative with supporting us in some ways, the Primary Care Access Stabilization Group, which has another 9 or 10. And then there's also an Integrated Behavioral Health Work Group that we're participating in, which is another 9 or 10. So it just gets to accumulate over time. So it does get to be how do they overlap, and what's the national, if there's a national priorities or if there are local priorities, which is maybe more important, what are the local priorities, and how does the health center sort of like find itself integrated into that process, and then it does get acted upon.
Related to that question is two things. One is that, you know, that CMS meaningful use listed chlamydia only under OBGYNs, you know, as so only accountable for those individuals. So one would be a question of, is there, you know, your organization's responding to that CMS call for maybe talking about, one, the measures being applicable to broader, you know, primary care, that was one of the issues. But the broader question is that, what are the carrots and sticks to make those mm-hmm. changes, and mm-hmm. how both in the law, like for example, Iowa, you know, having the law is one thing, but having the clout to make it happen, what are the states, what are the penalties you pay, what are the incentives that are in place to make it happen? And then larger, how are you going to move quality? How are you going to encourage provider compliance, particularly when you start having a plethora of measures? Everybody's going to have measures. Mm-hmm. You know, how are the ones that are most important going to be decided, and how to work with the possible levers?
You're so right. I did want to address the question that you did ask earlier about that in terms of the incentives, if you will, because I think it's there are some initiatives that are going on. We in Point have one locally where, in terms of what was tied into us receiving funds, was achievement of NCQA certification. It was optional. But to the degree that you receive that certification, you receive the bonus payment as a result. And this is something that CMS was sponsoring under a demonstration project. And so it was a local decision how to structure, you know, that incentive so that, in fact, we got paid more for receiving NCQA 1 or 2 or 3 certification, which was, and as a result of that, in our safety net community of safety net providers, and there are about 3 community federally qualified health centers, but there are about another 15 organizations which are not, and more than half of them receive NCQA certification because of that as an incentive. And I think the other part, it has to do with the around the realm of managed care. The medical home model, I think, is an excellent tool for managed care for the perspective that in the end, in developing the whole system of care coordination and those kinds of things, what really drives the bottom line for managed care organizations, the health plan, if you will, is keeping people out of the emergency room, reducing, you know, those kinds of extended stays, visits, et cetera. And so to the degree you get better care delivered in the medical home, that care coordination does achieve that. So the bonus then gets to be mostly in the structure of shared pools at the end of the day. You know, that's where the incentive is that if we achieve certain goals, we're reducing, you know, the ER visits, we're reducing, you know, our rate of recidivism for asthma, for diabetes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then we're going to get paid for that. And so that indirectly, I think, is a good driver, even within the context of managed care.
I just want to address that again in terms of what we're doing in Massachusetts. We're part of a 5-state initiative to look at implementation of patient-centered medical home under the Commonwealth Fund in Qualys in Oregon, Washington. We are looking at some payment reform in Massachusetts that is going to allow the involved health centers and some private practices to receive per patient per month increase in reimbursement if they meet the work of medical home, not necessarily at this point to receive NCQA recognition, although we are working for that, but that you're putting in place the actual practice transformation. So that has yet to be put into law, but it's being worked on. So that's one of the carrots. I will say, though, at our health center, doing chlamydia and gonorrhea screening is part of our well woman care. And as you said, it's just well woman care. But I think probably in our state, most of the numbers that get reported are from the health centers, because that's just a standard of our quality of care. Our numbers of chlamydia diagnoses have increased. I mean, it's gone up 18% in the past year. So, you know, what are we doing? What needs to be done differently? But we are reporting on it. And a lot of that's tied to our Title 20 funding that we do for family planning services in the health center. I'm not sure. I think maybe because we're routinely doing screening for those women.
Was there a policy change in like 2008 or 2007?
Not that I'm aware of. We have had since 2008 a turnover in our provider staff. This is not just for our community health center. It's for our catchment area that 18% increase in new diagnoses, but I know that routineness of testing has become embedded in our primary care practice, and not by policy, but by practice. Okay.
I'm actually a chair of the board for a community health center, and also I'm a Ryan White provider. So one of the questions I have about started knowing me. But one of the questions I have is that it seems like there's a collision between, for us, the HRSA productivity standards that we receive and being able, like our most comprehensive, thorough providers are our worst producers. Mm-hmm. And it's like that's a never-ending collision. And at this point, you know, it's federal dollars that we need, so productivity wins. How are you dealing with that?
The question is, I'm supposed to be repeating the question. The question is how does HRSA's productivity specifications impact the medical home implementation, and how do you reconcile that since some of the providers who provide the most comprehensive care, their productivity is less? Would you like?
It's not an easy response to that, in that, for one thing, I think it really, a lot of that unfortunately depends upon, for example, the HRSA program officer that you have. Because there is some variability in terms of what really drives, or if you will, the responsibility of the local board in determining the productivity level for its own community and its own staff. There are some ways in which that productivity is unfortunately built into boilerplate, for example, for Medicare cost reporting, but it's not in Medicaid. And unfortunately, there was a practice of years ago, yes, you had to meet those 4,200 per, for example, encounters per provider, but that was later changed, but it didn't change the mindset of HRSA. And again, so it's sort of like you're built with the legacy issue there, but you know, as a community health center, I can speak from personally, you know, that we do have the conflict, of course, even within our own organization. You have our CFO, of course, who wants to see the productivity numbers go up. Our CMO says, well, that's not the important thing. You know, so, and it gets, that's why, the board has to sort of like get in the balance of that and to say, you know, for its own purposes, particularly when you go into something like a medical home model, you know, it's not the number of encounters, you know, that's really driving it. It's really the quality and the appropriateness of care that we're doing. And that, yes, we'll have to evaluate, you know, what's happening with your provider's productivity, what have you, but we're also looking at those other benchmarks that are happening in terms of that decreasing in A1C, et cetera.
I just want to make a brief comment on that, that one of the ways that we are working on this is in the development of our teams, and so that every person in the team is working at the top of their license or their job description and doing as much work as possible in the care of the patient to take as much as possible off the plate of the providers so that the providers aren't doing education if a nurse can do it. The nurse isn't doing screening questions if the medical assistant can do it. And we're really working on changing our job descriptions and our policies around that.
Let me add to that in terms of that, because that's a very important point in terms of the working through that process. And so, in fact, it may not technically improve your productivity levels for your provider, but it really means that you're doing the right care at the right time by the right party.
Okay.
Yeah, I had two questions. One maybe is related to one of the comments that were just made. And I'm curious about what sort of measures, it's almost like banking, where there's a bottom line, but there's also sort of regulation, at least proposed regulation that we need more of to try to prevent the bottom line from dominating. And I'm wondering what role there is for, you know, metrics like patient satisfaction surveys. I mean, my wife works in a community health center, and I hear this every night over dinner, as, you know, this productivity quality drive piece. And to balance out what your CFO is looking at, what are plausible measures to try to enhance that balance? That's question one. And then the other question is, I love the carrot sticks metaphor, and I'm quite interested as to what carrots and issues work at the local level. So in other words, one is trying to make decisions at the local level. I assume that it's board education about community needs and whatnot, but you know, from a STD, HIV perspective, obviously the Massachusetts situation seems to have a high level of attentiveness to this, and can you help us understand the dynamics of how local boards make those tough choices?
The question is, what other metrics are around sort of the productivity at, besides just the cost, around probably patient satisfaction and staff satisfaction, and then followed by what happens on the board, what's the carrot and stick around changing some of this or moving things forward?
Remember, I was talking about those three different collaboratives that we were working on, et cetera, et cetera. Each one of them has a patient satisfaction or patient perception component to it. And so that is something that our board gets very sensitive to, that they are, we're constantly trying to improve or to recognize and to deal with what are the patient's patient's perceptions related to the quality of care that they're getting, the access to care that they're getting. And so that helps, and that's just reported to the board just as much as that productivity ratio is. Mm-hmm. And see the other part.
It's sort of help us understand the life at the local board level in terms of making tough choices about what to emphasize, what not to emphasize.
Realize that for a community health center, the 51% of the board members are actually users of services. So, you know, it's them. They get it. And so to the degree that when we're talking about things about, for example, the patient satisfaction, and one of the things, for example, is the waiting time for a next appointment, or to the how many times does the phone ring before somebody picks it up, you know, it's real to them.
And just to add that in Massachusetts, our most recent meeting of the group of community health centers that's working on the Commonwealth Fund Qualis issue just spent the whole meeting talking about the patient satisfaction surveys that we use. And again, these are all community health centers whose board members are 50% patients. But there's also a sense that patients, even though we send out surveys, that a lot of patients aren't used to being asked what they think about their care, and that we need to educate patients about their right to ask those questions and to make their opinions known.
I think the gym is good.
Okay, just on a national level, what's happening on that? Actually, I was hired to do patient surveys back in 1991 for my 6-month job. And I'm still here. There is a lot in flux around patient experiences, and I think it's the patient experience. It's not it's not satisfaction. It's the experience, and so that's the latest term. As regarding staff, we actually have 2 webinars on our website that look specifically at that, and I would highly recommend you visit our website because there's fascinating data on where to put your energies. On a national level, funded by the Commonwealth Fund, we are actually analyzing data sets, one on the organizational structure and capacity around the medical home model. There was a 73% response rate by health centers on their capacity issues. And we are using, we're doing a cross analysis with the staff of satisfaction to look at what are those metrics that do that, and that should be out in within about 6 months. I don't know who is next. Do you want to, sir? Yeah?
My name is Sebastian. I'm a doctor in England, and I work with primary care health centers just like you described. And England, things have been changing for the last 10 to 20 years, and we're moving towards larger healthcare centers. A few things. I'm involved in community screening, and what we find in England is that there's not a clear link between financial incentives and screening. In fact, it almost seems that the ones who believe in screening, they screen for nothing. So what we're trying to do is motivate GPs or doctors and making them realize that community is an important issue, then we screen. Part of the problem is that the money they receive goes into big pots. Doesn't get more money if he or she screens more. So that's part of the problem. My question is, and that's what we find, who does the screening? Because a lot of doctors in England, they say, well, you're actually hijacking the patient agenda. He or she is going for a sore throat, and you talk about chlamydia, and then the patient feels like, I'm here for a sore throat, and then he's asking about a sore throat. throat, but they keep on going on my chlamydia. And so how do you model this? Because we in England, the consultation is about 10 minutes, and we try to add it on at the very end of a consultation, and often it opens a can of worms. So we talk about chlamydia, and then the patient talks about poison and so forth.
Right. I'll address that real quickly because that's what we tested in our HIV model. And our providers are the same. If they can't act on it, if it kind of ruins their day, their hearts start racing, they have adrenaline rush, whether it be a mental health, a depressed patient, an abnormal sugar, it isn't just routine screening. It would be all of those that would change their schedules. And in our model, which is on our website on the HIV, we actually designed a model working with 6 health centers and 21 sites. And it started with the scheduler who calls and reminds the patients. We say, we're offering a new service here. We're doing routine screening, the lab person, every person. And so we spread it out through the entire patient process and patient experience. And the provider only had to give the results. So it was just a second. And then they would turn them over to whoever was their support system to do the follow-up, reschedule, retest, and all of that. So that's what we actually need are the models, because the providers don't have the time to design those models. And I'll be happy to discuss it further offline. But it's very, actually in our health centers, the cycle time for the patient increased by 2 to 3 minutes. That's it. The lady in the brown suit.
I'm always curious with community health centers and other entities that provide primary care to an underinsured population, whether you have the appropriate mechanisms for engaging in that dialogue with your community specialists and hospitals, because I know that that relationship can get dicey at times. Mm-hmm. It's dicey if you live in a community that has a charity hospital. Right. There are some communities, one I know best is Washington, D.C., doesn't have a charity hospital.
Right.
10 years ago. So how does that work? Has that been a sticking point, or have you worked that work around?
The question was really around the care coordination and core management between entities like hospitals, outpatient, and how that's being managed in this new medical home model. I'll let Mike and Luann address that since they have to design that.
Right, and from two different worlds.
Yes.
Because, for example, in our situation in New Orleans, the patient population we're seeing, we have 70% uninsured at this point in time. And so, yes, it's a very difficult thing in terms of managing that interface between the specialty care and the diagnostic resources that are needed for an uninsured population. And it's designed, and we do it as best as we can, but it is a responsibility. The way that the medical home model and our system was built is that is an assigned responsibility for somebody to take over that task and do, you know, so that it's at the point in time where the physician makes an order to, you know, for a referral to a specialist, what have you. It is tasked to someone, and it doesn't go away until it's done. And again, that may mean it may not be done for several months if there's a waiting list for that particular resource. But at least it's in the process.
Ours is, as Mike said, a very different situation. Our health center went from being 25% uninsured population before our Massachusetts healthcare reform to 3% of our population being uninsured. And a large number of those patients became enrolled in a health insurance product that was developed by what was the largest safety net hospital in the state, Boston Medical Center, which was Boston City Hospital before it became privatized. So what they have developed with us is a daily reporting from Boston Medical Center of every patient of ours that has gone to the emergency room, gone to a specialty visit, or who has been admitted. So, and then it gets referred back to the nurse on the team for that patient's continuing care provider to work with the provider and decide what follow-up needs to be done. And it's not something that a medical secretary can do. It needs to have the critical thinking skills of a nurse to be able to figure out what the patient needs, whether they need a telephone call to remind them to come in, whether they need to actually call the hospital and speak with the care manager on that floor where the patient is. So that's just one hospital, and granted, our patients can have, you know, many, many choices of their hospital care, but they tend to go to certain hospitals by each health center. Our other health center on the other side of Dorchester has a relationship with a different hospital, and they don't quite have that system in place, but having been exposed to the system that Boston Medical Center has, they will really work with the other hospital to develop that system.
Yeah, it's another, just on that whole care coordination is very complex. That capacity, that has to be built.
Right.
That, and the IT is the easy part. One health center in upstate New York who has multiple providers, including private sector, public health departments, and hospitals, what they have done in their care management, which I think is a very interesting approach because they also deal with complex patient populations culturally. They have migrant, mobile populations. So the way they do it is they do it by level of need by the patient. So if a patient doesn't speak English, they have comorbidities, they have uninsured, then that is piggybacking on what Luann said, the complexity of cognitive skills to manage that. The patients that have those cultural challenges on top of financial and comorbidity have a different level of person than somebody who's just being referred for a test. Yes?
The experience of trying to make specifically chlamydia the testing routine. And that is, someone alluded to, this gentleman from London alluded to the idea of the provider having a heavy workload. And what we found is also the medical assistants have a really heavy workload. But the group of employees at this particular system that did not have an over scheduled day were the health educators. And since chlamydia and gonorrhea can now be tested for with urine tests, we're trying to work with them to, first of all, to educate the health educators because they're mostly focused on chronic diseases and to make, you know, STIs be something that they're comfortable talking about. And to actually, you know, train them to be the people who ask the patients for specimens and are familiar with the procedures and that sort of thing. So that just in our state, this one plan, this is like the one group of employees that, you know, could actually maybe take on a little bit more.
Right. To piggyback on that and to share in the context of the medical home model and areas of opportunity and the way health centers are structured, if you're going to form a relationship with a health center, I highly recommend you go to the CEO. If you want really to routinize any screening, you really want a collaborative model, we all would like to go to the easy touch, which is usually a line staff person. But that line staff person may or may not have the authority and influence to move it through the system. That might just be their champion project. So our experience in launching anything is we work the CEO and the board to get buy-in before we move forward. And Mike, you might want to piggyback on that.
No, I think that's very appropriate, as well as perhaps getting the medical director, because you need a medical champion for that too.
And the CFO.
Mm-hmm. He'll take orders. He'll take orders.
All right, the person in the vest there. Yeah.
This conflict that, you know, every facility is going to have between productivity and quality. Some demonstration efforts on that. How, and this gets out to, you know, the relationship between the health centers and HRSA, how, to what extent are there national solution and national models that you think you're working towards that could be replicated
both for the health centers to sort of balance that? How do you, how do you do that? What does it look like to, you know, not saying you need the health educator, but how do you assess your use of your staff? How do you figure out how to be most productive? You know, how do you maximize that butter and alms relationship, you know, and health centers? And is that something that's being pursued? You know, how to develop, you know, an operational structure that allows you to work towards optimizing, you know, productivity and quality?
I think I'm going to do a philosophical, and then I'll defer to Luann and Mike how it happens on the ground. Health centers at the root of their culture are based on innovation and change. And one of the things we launched in 1999 is the Health Disparities Collaborative. And that was a very different experience because for the first time, we all have rules, we all have expectations, we all have productivity measures. Very little of that yields staff satisfaction and keeps people engaged. Health center people have, our health center staff have hard lives. They work hard, they're mission driven, and they do it for usually less than other people do it. The one thing that we found, and that's why it's sort of built into that medical model, it's hard work. But people like to work in teams. They like to know what all those pieces are doing, and that's why it's being integrated in some of the legislation and some of the expectations. The thing that hasn't been documented that was the real wall factor, and I can tell you that because I did a lot of research on it, was health centers during that time between 1999 and 2005 during the Health Disparities Collaborative became learning organizations, where they were able to test things and learn from them. They were given autonomy to change the system. They were given autonomy to say that doesn't work and I can let go of that in the context of that environment. And I would say that's one of those intangible things is when you're learning, it offers your staff and patients that you're actually making a difference. And I think, you know, that is something that isn't often talked about, but it showed up on every debrief, everything we did, is when the organization is learning. That doesn't mean sending your staff to training, that it's actually built into the way they work is a very positive influence for change. And I'll defer.
We were actually talking about this last night, that one of the models that we use as part of practice transformation to move closer to what is described as a medical home is doing quick cycle evaluations, the PDSA model. So we have a huddle of our clinical staff every week, and that focuses on something using PDSA that we are working on. If it doesn't work, then we brainstorm and try to find out another way to make it work. So.
Mike, do you want to?
I'm not sure you thought about the possibility of teaching that to some of the health departments, because they don't use that system too widely.
The PDSA model?
Yeah.
I would guess that that's because of the way they need to accumulate data in the broader scope. I don't know.
Actually, there is a model for that. And when we ran the Diabetes Collaborative, we actually partnered with the Diabetic Prevention workers on the ground. They attended all of the learning teams, they attended all the learning environments, and they leveraged. And that's actually was a fascinating, what they could produce in a short amount of time because they had defined roles, they met at the table, they were working together, they went to the same learning teams and the collaborative things, so there was no language issue, they became part of the learning team. And so there is a model that has worked out there. It has not been, I have to say, I think by the way the funding and the whole history around HIV and STDs, they've been kind of sidelined. And so I think part of it is for us to bring it back into the mainstream. Yes?
I'm wondering, looking at these entities,
mm-hmm. there are multiple forums, and I think it's an opportunity. What I see at the national, there's a primary care provider coalition meeting that is working nationally, and it has all the big players like the Quality Forum, all of those. It has Medicaid, Medicare there at the table. They are working on these measures. But I think in actual practice, what you're seeing is the primary care people are lumping together and doing healthcare home initiatives, the financing and reimbursement, the researchers. And actually, we're in the process of designing and having a healthcare home summit where we're breaking down those walls and have them all in the same room. Because it's tricky on the measures. What the researchers want to come up with cannot actually come out of the EMR system and isn't the way medicine is being practiced. So they have to be in the same room.
I just wanted to make an additional comment that one of the things that we've found, we're a fairly rural area, and the advent of telemedicine in terms of expanding our ability to be a primary home site, home care site. We've added high-risk OB and HIV, and it's just another piece. And not only does it provide access, but it's another, what you were saying, that it's a great training model for our staff to expand their skills. So if you can, we got a grant to get the equipment that was the real initial outlay.
Right.
It's been easy to find people to partner with us to want to provide those services.
Right.
So it would be a great subset to.
Right, the telemedicine is huge in health centers, especially when there's disciplines that behavioral health, those very complicated cases, rural areas. That also is playing a huge role, though, legislatively and administratively on HIPAA. I mean, there's a lot, if you talk to the lawyers, they're very much on the fence about it. But if you talk to the clinicians, they think it's great. But I think that that's innovation to us. That's a great contributor. And many sites around the country use it and do it well. Back there. You. Sorry. He doesn't want to touch that.
Well, I believe in our health center it would come under the umbrella of any of our Title 20 care that we deliver. I think there are innovative ways to do that. Community health centers, in a lot of ways, are very small groups of people so that everybody kind of knows everybody. So I think if you were able to build the strong relationship between the provider and the team and the patient, it wouldn't be a big step to engage the partner. Now, granted, there are a lot of other issues that go with that partner notification piece, but I think the relationship between the patient and the provider team is what could bring in the partner for notification.
It's a very good question, and it varies by health center. I think that came out in the June 4th and 5th meeting that the health centers actually didn't know that was available about partner referral. And so part of it is they just actually don't know the services and they don't have the time or capacity to look at that on a concrete measure. And in our model, we have found introduction and a sort of a brown bag lunch with the DIS officer, and health centers work like a village. It's all about the relationship. And so you have to invest in the relationship first before you can move anything. And we have found the DIS to be very effective contact in doing that.
He has a former DIS on his staff.
That's recruit from others. That's a very important strategy. Yes?
Yeah, I had two questions. One was, you made a point a few minutes ago about STD and HIV being somewhat sidelined, I think, in contrast, I think, to chronic disease care. Mm-hmm. And that's related to funding streams. Mm-hmm. And what would it take to more mainstream that? Can you say a little bit more about how that functional sidelinization happens?
Do you want me to take it? You want to take it first?
I'll take a crack at it first. I think for example, that it is hard for many community health centers to feel as part of the family, to be invited into that world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the slides that was referenced in terms of, for example, the opportunity for free test kits, those kinds of things. When a community health center is providing the breadth of services that it is, you know, it usually looks to see, okay, well, what am I funded to do, like everyone else does, and how much can I stretch the dollars to do more than that? And to the degree that you provide them something of added value, even if it's the free test kits, I think they'll go out of their way to wrap the services around because it's what they want to do, but they may not have the direct services, the opportunity for paying, for example, for adding on another $10,000, $15,000 a year, you know, for test kits and those kinds of things, if they depending upon the cost. But they already have some of the other things built in terms of case management and some of the other pieces that you might want to have. It's just that they say, well, we can't afford the test kits, you know, for one. And so it's a way of really just trying to find out, you know, to the degree that you're building, as Kathy said, on those relationships and to the degree that you may be able to provide something that they don't have immediate access to. And I think, you know, and understanding what your needs are, and as was also pointed out, looking at what the community needs are, because that's where we're going to be, that's what's going to help drive them. Case in point, when we were looking at our community assessment about 10 years ago, and we were looking at, of course, the traditional things in terms of, okay, what was the heart disease rate, you know, what was the hypertension rate, et cetera, and we had designed our plans in terms of our organizational priorities. It was a board member who said, I read something about the rate of HIV in our community. You know, what are we going to do about that? And that became a priority.
We did do that. Unfortunately, the primary care, the way they work, they already start their day usually behind, and that they actually, it's not built in necessarily into the line provider staff to build that design, that model of bringing in somebody. And even just providing test kits, is you have to build in for a health center, what they're gonna have to do is, one, there's gonna have to be the IT infrastructure, how to capture that test, where to document it, where to do that. They have to create the follow-up and registry system if there is a reactive. Then they're also gonna have to train all of the staff, not one staff person, but all of the staff to do that. It has to go into the scheduling. It has to go into the practice management system, and has to go into the workflow and all of that. So it's not just, why aren't they doing testing? That's why we keep going back. You really need to work with the CEO and the leadership. When we rolled out our model, we actually spent 1 year working with board members first. And then we had CEO, they know, they're quick, they get it. But working with the needs of the medical staff was very different, and he left. But I think one of the important things that was a real aha for us is because the way the providers are trained, the message to them was they are not capable of doing HIV. And so our big learning curve was giving our providers permission to give those results. We actually had to script it for them. And then how to deal with false positives. Because they said, we get bad news all day. That is not new to us. But because HIV had been over here, they didn't feel the confidence that they needed to be given. Those are my words. But it was very interesting because that, when we asked what they needed, that's what they needed.
I just have a comment on that. At our three agencies, or at least the two Boston agencies, the HIV-STI screening and referral to treatment and case management is very involved in the health centers. Our biggest problem is the consent, and the provider has to be the one that does the education around the consent in Massachusetts. And so that really disrupts the clinical flow. We're trying to move towards screening and consent by exception that people who don't want to be tested need to sign out of it. But we're working on that.
And that's why a lot of the issues around HIV and STD, there are structural issues within the state that things happen the way they happen. Is there any other questions that we can help you with?
Thinking about going forward, one of the challenges, you can imagine that there's health departments, let's say your responsibility for improving, let's say, compliance with recommendations across the whole community. Mm-hmm. That's whether it's chlamydia screening, HIV testing, imagine the list, a finite list, but maybe a rather long list. How does it make sense for them to be working with, the health centers in their jurisdictions, have them part of that solution? How you present the case as a package, how you reach some sort of agreement about prioritization, and is that a reasonable kind of role to that chart you showed about the coming together? Where on that is agreeing on a priority and a plan for making sort of change? Is that a reasonable kind of planning step to be having once a year? How do you organize that if it makes sense to be doing it?
Do you want me to do it?
Start off.
Okay, I'll start up. I can tell you what worked and what didn't work. what worked is we started out by putting all the partners together at a luncheon, said this is what we're going to do, this is what's going to happen. In actuality, I think designing who that health center people, and especially the clinical staff, they're not funded to go to meetings. You're never going to have them at a meeting. I'll be honest. It just doesn't work that way. The other struggle we had was around training. Historically, AETCs, health departments, they want 1 hour or 4 hour, 8 hour trainings. You know, when we had our trainings, we said, you have 8 minutes. And they went, what? And we said, yeah, you have 8 minutes. Because you have 45 minutes, we're gonna deliver this in 45 minutes. This is what you're gonna address. They said, I need 8 hours to address stigma. Can't happen. So what we did is work with them and those that were willing to do it. But I gotta tell you, the number one hook was the data and the prevalence data. And that's what, I don't think you say, I wanna involve all health centers. You go to that zip code and you say, we need your help. Mm-hmm. This is the data. And then you work with the CEO, the medical director, and the board, and you design your solution. I can't give you anything more than that, but I will give it to.
Going back to relationships, familiarity with one another is going to be very important, and you've got to work on that. We're all sort of like captives of our own communities to a degree, too, if it doesn't seem to be a priority for the community, and we haven't done a good job of educating our community about what the needs are as well. So again, that prevalence data, how is it getting out there? And so to the degree that the community decides it's important as well. One of the important things that I learned in terms of when we were doing the Turning Point Collaborative many years ago was that We traditionally go into the communities and we're really talking about it from our world, from the perspective of, yes, we want to talk about what's the HIV, what's the STD rate, what's the diabetes, and that's what we go into the communities with our agenda, and theirs is a lot more common in terms of, well, my kid doesn't have a place to play. And so to the degree that we start those partnerships and make it really bilateral, And I think then the community, when they get onto something that they think is important, and if it does relate to the fact that yes, there is a you know, that our kids in school are, you know, or have in our school has the highest chlamydia rate, you know, in the parish in our case or what have you, then they're going to start demanding things about what people are doing about it too.
I just want to say something about the data. As I said, my STI experience is integrated, and it didn't become aware to me until I became a director of nursing and had exposure to the data. So I think any ways that we can get data out to the frontline people can emphasize the importance of doing that work.
I just like to comment because I want to tell a story, because this is a true story. When we went in with the HIV non-Ryan White Health Centers, and we were trying to work with the local health department, and the state will remain unknown, the CEO and we had got it through the health center, 6 sites, routine testing across all sites. But in order for them to partner with us, they needed to have all their referral points in place and some affiliation agreement that they would take the positives. And we went, and it was a team approach, and we went to the local health department, and they said, yes, we have 91 DIS officers, and you just send it to us, and then they'll go and confirm that that patient is indeed that person. And the CEO says, but where can we refer them? And they says, well, it's a lottery, and we can't tell you who to refer. And he says, well, where's the name? Why can't I just call them directly and say, this is, it doesn't work that way? And he said, I know these people. They are my patients. They've been coming to the health center. I will find my own way. And he found his own way, and it was with a private provider. That's something wrong if you can't remove those barriers. He set up the whole referral network and positives outside the health department because they were so loyal to their systems. The health center is going to be loyal to that patient, and they are going to do whatever to be loyal to that patient. So that, I just use that as an illustrative, you know, that you have to be willing to put some muscle behind that collaboration.
We just hired the CEO out of the Ryan White ranks.
Great.
Oh, good. You go. Where are you from? We better come and visit.
I was just going to echo what you've said about relationships because, in fact, I'm in the division of STD, and we actually did have a really nice collaborative with HRSA, with the health centers through the Bureau of Primary Health Care. And actually, it got to the point where we even had involved in that the Agency for Families and Children. So we had what we had was the old Community Action Agency, the Community Health Center in that same vicinity, working together with the CDC to do not only outreach, but then get people enrolled into the medical home and the community health center. And so, but it was all about building that relationship with the CEOs and getting them engaged. And so we were working in El Paso, Indianapolis, and in Boulder County, Mississippi. And it actually really worked because people were really engaged, and we had these two entities. So we had the outreach arm and the Community Action Agency, who's out there all the time, and people forget. The Community Action Agencies are still around, still doing their work, and they're doing all this lovely outreach. So they were carrying the prevention messages and saying people need to be thinking about these issues and getting yourself, you know, checked out. And then we had the health center working as the medical home, and it was a way to get people into the health services system as well. So I can't emphasize enough the role of relationship. And the other thing that's really important here is that CDC did put money into it. We actually committed, you know, substantial amounts of money to support that effort. Unfortunately, you know, bureaucratic things happened. And it wasn't the CDC that stopped this time. It was the Bureau of Primary Health Care who couldn't get a memo signed. But we did have a meaningful relationship over several years. We provided training to the health center staff and to the action agency staff. So they got their basic STD 101, and they were able and empowered to be these partners in their local areas. But it was all at the local level.
Yep. All right. I think do you want to comment on that?
Oh, no. I just want to reemphasize the point. I think you made the point of the day in terms of the loyalty to the patient, that really that's the fulcrum for the community health centers. It's what we revolve our world about, from the board members, you know, and that are users to the providers who tend to stay in our systems for years. You know, so they have a patient base. They're as much of a private practitioner in a public setting as you would probably want to get in terms of their patient loyalty and how they want to see things operate.
That is a myth buster. Everybody thinks that turnover in health centers is really high. It's actually a lot less than the national healthcare industry. Our providers and our staff stay longer than others. And I just, in closing, I want to thank you very much, but as Raul know, I think it's really important as we're having all these talks to understand the role of public safety and those patients and individuals that are in and out of correctional institutions and jails, that they really are the same population, and that's a population that seems to be more and more sidelined. Do you want to say anything in closing?
If you don't know where your local community health center is, go to the National Association site, and there's a link to your primary care association, and you can find your community health center.
Thank you for your morning, your attention.
Thank you.